My name is Jeffrey Davis, and I want to thank our friends and our partners for Radio Entrepreneurs at Gray, Gray & Gray, the accounting firm in Canton, Mass., who've been hosting us all week. Sitting beside me, but not with a headset on, is Rich Hershen, who will be my co-host this week.
As soon as the technical difficulties get straightened out, I will be here.
Yeah, as soon as we get our technical difficulties straight out, we'll put Rich on the phone. We also have Gary Goldman, the ice cream genius. He's sitting in the other side of the room. So, but on the line, we have our reporter Mark Furman from the law firm Tarlow, Breed, Hart and Rogers. Welcome back, Mark. Tell our listeners congratulations to you and your family on the nuptials of your son.
Oh, thanks very much. Very exciting.
Yeah, very exciting. So, Mark, in addition to your son, anything big that we need to talk about today?
Well, I wanted to talk about an interesting case that involved an investment in a company that became very successful, and which was memorialized by a couple of letters, and kind of interesting to see what happened with it. So, in 1988 and 1999. An investor named Robert James advanced $650,000 to the former CEO of First Marblehead, a gentleman named Dan Myers. And the purpose was to purchase stock in that company, which at the time was young and privately held. And a share offering was being done by First Marblehead, and Mr. Myers and another senior person at First Marblehead did not have the capital to invest. So Mr. James agreed to help them invest, and the agreement was memorialized by a couple of letters that set out formulas under which the proceeds of the sale of the stock would be distributed between and among Mr. James's charitable foundation and Mr. Myers and this other gentleman, Mr. Ambinder. And these two letters did not discuss when the stock would be sold. But the basic idea would be that something along the lines of the first 50% of appreciation in the stock would go to Mr. James as the investor, his foundation, and the balance of any profit would be split 50-50. And Mr. James was a very successful business person, according to the decision in the case. And what this meant was that Mr. Myers and Mr. Ambinder would not be diluted. They'd retain the same ownership in First Marblehead as they would had they had their own capital to invest, so that was the benefit for them. So First Marblehead became at the time wildly successful, and it went public in 2003. The value increased incredibly over time, and the shares that Myers ultimately received almost $2.5 million in dividends alone from the shares that he was able to purchase as a result of this letter agreement with Mr. James Foundation. So Mr. James and members of his family wanted to finish the investment. They wanted to have the shares sold. They wanted to have a discussion with Mr. Myers about doing that. They made an agreement with Mr. Ambinder to deal with his shares, but Mr. Myers took the position that as the owner of the stock, he retained unfettered discretion to decide when it would be sold, and he had no interest in selling it. Mr. Myers did, however, sell other shares that he owned in the company at tremendous profits, but he refused to agree to liquidate these shares that he was able to purchase through the funds advanced by Mr. James's foundation. So ultimately, in 2006, Mr. James and his foundation brought suit claiming that Mr. Myers had breached covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And Mr. Myers said, wait a minute, we have no agreement that I have to ever sell the shares. I have a right to retain these shares until I decide to sell them. Well, they had a trial in the here in Boston, and at the end of the trial, the trial judge said, Mr. Myers, you breached the obligation you had of good faith to negotiate resolution of the deal under which the shares would be sold, and therefore you're liable for the damages suffered by the James Foundation. Now, first Marblehead took a devastating negative turn in the value of the shares following the 2008 recession, and the court said that by 2006, Myers had breached his obligation. So that meant that the damages were tremendous, because the valuations of the shares in 2006 were basically at peak. We're not talking about minor returns here. We're talking of gigantic returns based upon stock splits and things of that nature. So Mr. Myers, unhappy with the decision, appeals to the appeals court, and they reverse. They say, no, there's no, he had no obligation under the agreement. All these short letters don't talk about Mr. Myers' obligations to sell, and therefore the appeals court reverses. Well, the James Foundation asked the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts to review the decision, and they take it, and they reverse the appeals court and reinstate and affirm the decision of the trial court, finding for the foundation and against Myers. The spread here in these different decisions is just millions and millions of dollars, and it's one of the few times where there has been a decision of a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair, where there was no express breach of contract. That's what makes the case a little bit from a lawyer's perspective, but from a business person's perspective, here you have, it looks like, two different expectations of the parties. Mr. Myers' expectation is he could hold these shares forever and then sell them when he thought it was appropriate in his discretion. That was not the expectation of the James Foundation. So in order to get the expectations aired out so there's truly a meeting of the minds, having this kind of investment memorialized by a short letter is just an invitation to future misunderstandings and future litigation. I mean, it is a giant hole in the letter. You know, who's going to decide when these shares are going to be sold? Is it going to be at a particular moment in time? Who gets the deciding vote? The letter didn't answer that question, so the parties ended up in litigation in 2006, and in judicial court ending the litigation in 2016, 10 years later.
Wow. So, you know, markets, again, it gives me the feeling about how people go into organizations together as investors, as shareholders, and they're very optimistic and they start with very loose agreements. And then down the road, they're kind of stuck with each other because they have not looked out into the future and tried to plan for it from the start.
That's right. You know, everybody goes into deals with thinking about everything that's positive that's going to come out of it and not really considering the possibility that people will have different views about what to do. I think there's an element here that the trial judge thought that Mr. Myers was, you know, personally profiting from selling shares by selling the shares that he got to keep all the money, while not selling the shares of in which the James Foundation would get the first piece of money and then 50% of the rest. And there was a letter that Mr. Myers sent at one point that suggested that he would be that he would want the foundation to take less money in return for his agreement to sell the shares now. So there's a little element in the trial judge's mind that, you know, he was trying to sweeten his own deal and trying to negotiate for a better deal and on the distribution of the from the sale. The judge liked that, and I think that reading between the lines may have been a reason. So, you know, here you have a case where there was no agreement on this critical deal point, and so the court, in effect, is imposing an obligation. You know, it says it's not imposing an agreement, just a duty to cooperate and act in good faith, but the end result is the stock has dramatically declined in value while Mr. James and his foundation are going to receive the benefit of 50% of the value at the high point, basically 2006, before the, you know, the crash that occurred a year or two later. So this result is just the worst possible result for Myers, because he has to pay for a value he's going to receive now.
Wow. Mark, interesting story, and again, makes me, you have my mind rambling about all the deals that I hear about from organizations. And, you know, when you go into business and you invest, you go into business knowing that you're going to get out of business at some point. And it's not like a marriage. And if you're not looking at that from the start and looking at scenarios, there's going to be problems. And, you know, you've been very good to sort of point that out. If somebody is in business, has shareholders, is going, you know, has an agreement, wants to look at the agreement, anything in that whole area, since you do a lot of work in the corporate area, how do they find you?
I can be reached at 617-218-2025 or at M. Furman, F-U-R-M-A-N, at tbhr-law.com.
Thank you, Mark. We look forward to hearing from you again next week.
Same here, Jeffrey.
Good. This is Radio Entrepreneurs. We will be right back after these messages.